the man with Gaddafi's golden gun, today on The World. In the chaos of the Libyan revolution, this reporter caught a glimpse of a man with a gun.
He was wearing a blue T-shirt with the word love in it, in a big heart shape in red, and a New York Yankees baseball cap. And he was being held up on the shoulders of his comrades. And he was waving this golden pistol.
Muammar Gaddafi's famous golden pistol. We find out what happened to it. Plus, editing the human genome could help fight disease, but
it's also become very controversial because, as you can imagine, editing human embryos or anything to do with reproductive science always raises eyebrows.
And Luxembourg wants to mine asteroids for resources. Really?
Luxembourg is actually a pioneer in commercial space development.
Alrighty then, that's all ahead on The World. Glad you could be here. The more we learn about the Zika virus, the more we understand it's a global thing, not restricted to any one place. Just ask Texas. Health officials there have confirmed the first documented case in the U.S. of Zika transmission from one person to another. It happened in the Dallas area, and scientists believe the patient became infected with Zika through sex with a partner who'd recently returned to the U.S. from Venezuela.
The real question is it a game changer? Are we going to suddenly see the virus change in its behavior and start to spread by the sexual route?
That's Jonathan Ball. He's a professor of molecular virology at Nottingham University in England, and he doesn't think the case in Texas is a game changer, and he doesn't expect sex to become a predominant way for the virus to spread.
There's nothing to suggest that that's going to happen. This is a virus which is primarily spread by mosquitoes, particularly the Aedes mosquito. And so the thousands, if not millions, of infections that we're seeing in Central and Southern Americas and parts of the Caribbean is purely down to mosquitoes biting an infected individual, carrying the virus, replicating it themselves, in fact, and then passing it on to somebody else.
Yeah, something you just said intrigued me, that the virus might change its behavior. Is it the virus that's actually changing its behavior, or is it the way humans interact that then affects the way the virus reacts?
Obviously, virologists are always keen and always interested in, to know whether viruses change and whether they mutate. Personally, I don't think that's what we're seeing here with Zika. We've seen a virus that's been living for probably tens of thousands of years in Africa and in Asia. And it's been well sort of embedded within the populations that live there. And those people are constantly exposed to the virus and they get immune to it. And therefore, they carry that immunity through life. And so you don't see these problems that we're seeing with Zika virus now, where it's essentially been introduced into a naive population. They haven't got any existing immunity in Southern America. They've never seen the virus before. And so it's easily spread from one person to another. Because we lead very different lives these days. We have global markets, we ship things from one end of the world to the other, and we all like to jump on a plane and travel to far-off tropical climes for holidays and things like that. And so this is perfect for viruses and their spread.
How common do you think this case in Texas is going to turn out to be, or you feel it's just going to be a one-off?
It won't be a one-off because we're seeing so many infections at the moment, but I think it will remain a very rare event, and most of the infections that we see will be down to mosquitoes passing the virus from person to person.
Rare event in that this case was spread through sexual means, right?
That's right, a rare event that it's sexually transmitted. But what it does mean, though, is that people have to be a little bit more aware. So the advice was for pregnant women to try and avoid travel to the worst affected areas. The advice is still don't go there. But of course, if you have a partner who goes to one of those areas, they could potentially be coming back with that virus. And therefore, there is a risk that they could then transmit that virus to you through sex. And that's why we've started to see advice where partners of pregnant women, if they have been to one of the affected areas, they're advised to not have unprotected sex. They're advised to wear a condom, and that's for 6 weeks after their return, and if they've shown any symptoms, for 6 months. And that's just to try and stop the risk of transmission through the sexual route to the most vulnerable people, and that's pregnant women.
Jonathan Ball, a professor of molecular virology at Nottingham University in England. Here's something else scientists are trying to figure out about Zika, how to develop a vaccine. That's something Brazil is very interested in. It's the country with the most Zika cases so far. But a vaccine's going to take time, and Brazil also has short-term worries. Rio de Janeiro is due to host the Olympics in just a few months, and officials are worried that the Zika outbreak could discourage visitors. My BBC colleague Julia Carnero reports on the economic impact of Zika already being felt in Rio.
It's a hot, sunny morning here in Rio, and hundreds of tourists are streaming out of the massive Queen Mary II. The ocean liner has just arrived here in the port and is carrying over 3,000 passengers. But when this cruise started early January in England, there wasn't that much news about the spread of the Zika virus. So how do people feel about arriving in Brazil?
We're taking all precautions possible with mosquito spray and that. Actually, the ship ran out of mosquito repellent, so we had to try and find some when we went ashore.
I don't think that we were terribly concerned. I think mainly because it's affecting pregnant women, and I'm not pregnant. But it did sort of give us pause because we are considering having another child.
With several countries advising pregnant women to postpone travel to areas with Zika, many airlines are offering to refund flights for those who no longer want to come to places like Brazil. In Rio, hotels are starting to register their first cancellations. Carnival starts on Saturday in Rio, and the mayor of Rio, Eduardo Paes, has come to visit the warehouses where the city's samba schools put together their famous parades. There are huge, colorful floats here. This is the warehouse of União da Ilha, and their theme this year are the Olympic Games in Rio. There's the Christ the Redeemer in a huge statue there, and one float has huge blue figures portraying the Greek gods. This will be the first test of whether the fear of the Zika virus will affect tourism here. And I asked the mayor what the impact may be on the games.
I don't think it's something that we have to worry for the Olympics. I mean, that time of the year, when we talk about August, it's a period of the year where this mosquito that spread this disease, it's not around. I mean, it happens on summertime. I mean, and if you take care of yourself, coming on carnival, it's not going to be a problem. Right?
If there's one sector that hasn't suffered from the economic crisis here in Brazil, that's the production of mosquito repellent. There has been a rush to drugstores to buy repellent, and here in this shop in downtown Rio, pharmacist Maxwell da Silva tells me pregnant women are putting their names on waiting lists for the product.
Demand is huge, and unfortunately, the industry is not managing to cope. Everyone's after a specific brand that's supposed to last longer, and when it arrives, it sells out in a few hours. It's crazy.
Tatiana Barreto is here with her niece. She says she's spending around $50 every month on repellent to protect her family from the Zika virus.
I've been coming here every week to buy repellent for my baby daughter and my sister who's pregnant. Everyone back home is really worried, and this is costing me a lot of money.
In one of Rio's busiest outdoor markets, another summer must-have is for sale, the electric racket to kill mosquitoes. Street vendor João Veridiano demonstrates how it works. Okay, so this noise is coming from sparks when he touches the grid with a metal tool. That's what happens with the mosquito when you hit it. He's electrocuted.
I love using this racket at home because mosquito bites are so annoying. With one charge on this, you can kill 500 mosquitoes.
Other than the rackets, though, João says sales are slow. At a time of economic recession, this public health crisis is another unexpected hit for Brazil.
The BBC's Julia Carnero reporting there from Rio de Janeiro on how Zika is affecting the Brazilian economy. Now to a different kind of health story. Regulators in Britain this week gave a group of researchers permission to use a controversial gene editing technique called CRISPR on human embryos. It's the first time this type of permission has been granted as technology in gene editing races ahead of regulations. Science reporter Alex Perlman has been covering CRISPR. Just give us the basics on CRISPR, Alex. It sounds like it really ought to be editing gene sequences on apples. but this is human embryos. What does it do?
First of all, CRISPR can be used on apples. It can be used on anything. It can also be used on plants, yeast, bacteria. But the big controversy is about human embryos. And basically, what CRISPR-Cas9 does is it can be directed at a certain point in DNA to remove negative genes or any kind of gene and then fuse those strands of DNA back together. Or it can also add in a supplementary gene and then fuse that in as well.
So the basic idea is that a scientist, a geneticist who would be doing this gene editing could take out certain characteristics of a subject that they don't like in the gene before that subject is in existence, and that will determine what that subject's going to look like.
Yes and no. So there's two different kinds of gene editing on human subjects right now. So the one that you're describing is germline editing, which is the kind of editing that can be inherited by the next generation. And researchers are very worried about moving forward with this. So that's actually not necessarily the focus. Now, the second kind of gene editing that researchers definitely do want to move ahead with is called somatic cell editing. And that's when you edit an adult cell. And researchers are looking at how we can cure Parkinson's disease, diabetes, beta thalassemia, sickle cell anemia. These kinds of diseases are also on the forefront of CRISPR research.
I mean, still, the UK was the first country to grant embryo research rights to scientists, and that would seem to kind of entail a really big development with all sorts of, frankly, alarming possibilities around cloning. I mean, that's a nightmare scenario. So what regulations are in place for CRISPR or any of the applications you've looked at? And who's in charge of making these rules?
So right now, the regulations in the UK, for example, are that the embryos cannot be implanted. It's illegal to implant them in women. They must be given by women who are undergoing IVF treatments and who consent to have their embryos researched on.
In vitro fertilization.
Right, yeah. In vitro. And then they have to be destroyed after 14 days. So those are the sort of broad accepted ethical guidelines for regulation. Unfortunately, in the United States, there are no regulations that specifically deal with CRISPR.
So China was undertaking gene editing, but there was no regulation or oversight per se. What problems do you see that leading to if the regulation is weak or even non-existent?
Yeah, one of the big concerns at a meeting of scientists that took place in D.C. last month was medical tourism and sort of havens where gene editing might exist without regulation. And right now, there isn't a consensus about how best to deal with that, although everyone agrees that it is concerning and it is a threat.
After the decision in the UK this week, a research team in London will be able to edit DNA of human embryos. They won't be allowed to implant those human embryos, but still, the decisions created a lot of controversy. Just run down, what are the big ethical concerns?
So there are a few, and the words designer babies tend to come out a lot. And the idea that you could have a bunch of babies born that have blonde hair and blue eyes. Another big concern is the cost of it might be quite high. So inequality is a big issue right now, because if it's only available in private labs, then only the wealthy will be able to access it and edit their own genes.
So, Alex, on the scale of big science headlines, this seemed really big to me. Green light for gene editing. How does it rank for you?
So for me, this is the number one thing. I think that gene editing will end up having a significant impact on our politics over the next 10 to 20 years, as well as the kind of medical treatments that everyone will be able to have access to.
Science reporter Alex Perlman, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Marco.
Still ahead, the man who saw Gaddafi's golden gun returns to Libya to find the man who hung onto it. That's later, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. The president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, has a shower head on top of his head. That's just one way South African cartoonist Zapiro depicts Mr. Zuma. It's a reference to a comment made by Zuma some years ago about showering after sex to avoid HIV. That controversy faded away, but for Zapiro, the shower head is still there. Taking a shower, though, won't do away with the current controversy dogging Mr. Zuma. He used millions in government funds to upgrade his private home near the town of Nkandla. Zuma says the upgrades were legitimate, that they were all about enhanced security. Critics say things like an amphitheater, visitor center, and swimming pool have nothing to do with security and that Zuma should pay up. Today, 6 years into the controversy known simply as Nkandla, President Zuma said he's now willing to reimburse the state for part of the cost. Jonathan Zapiro is Zapiro, the cartoonist. He joins me now. What is your reaction to President Zuma's change of heart?
It's not really a change of heart. What's happening is that a very, very big case brought by the main opposition, the Democratic Alliance, is coming to the Constitutional Court. You know, that's the apex court of the land. And the whole idea of that case is, in fact, to test the powers of the public protector, whose report it was right at the beginning that said that Zuma was supposed to pay back this money. And he has found every which way to try and obfuscate and try and pretend that the public protector's report is not the important report. So now that it's finally getting to the Constitutional Court, his lawyers have advised him to do this. He still says he doesn't agree with everything. Along the way, we've had the most absurd, ludicrous things where some of the things you mentioned, the swimming pool was called a fire pool because it was supposedly there to be able to put out fires on the thatched roofs.
Right. One of your cartoons, in fact, is called Nkandla Speak versus Actual Meaning. And you create this glossary to clarify what was added to Zuma's home in Nkandla, retaining wall means amphitheater. What were some of the other examples?
Well, yes, a fire pool, a swimming pool, essential security amenities, really, this is what they were called, were two soccer pitches for the security guards in their leisure time. Community clinic was actually a Zuma family clinic, and it was nothing to do, it was fenced off from the community. Retaining wall was, in fact, this amphitheater, and then I've got at the bottom there, president is actually a crook.
Zapiro, I may be wrong about this, but aren't South Africans so very conscious of African patriarchy and corruption in other countries around them that it would have been political suicide for their own head of state to not just go down that road, but, you know, still accumulate wealth? Why did Zuma think he could get away with all this?
You know, you've put your finger on a very, very difficult question. Zuma is very, very different from Nelson Mandela and Thabo Mbeki. You know, Thabo Mbeki may have been paranoid, aloof president, but he certainly was prepared to abide by constitutional provisions and that sort of thing. Nelson Mandela, of course, was had a huge regard for the constitution and the rule of law. Jacob Zuma is really, he's kind of a rural patriarch who was very much part of the struggle, great struggle hero, but he really does not appear to have a proper grasp of what it means to be accountable. He is flirting with the kind of banana republic stuff that we never, ever thought we would see in the new South Africa.
I remember in apartheid-era South Africa, activists used to chant Amandla, you know, meaning power. Have they replaced Amandla with Nkandla now?
Absolutely. It was the comedians, the stand-up comedians and cartoonists and things. Yes, of course, yeah.
Jonathan Shapiro, better known as Zapiro, a political cartoonist in South Africa and one of President Zuma's fiercest critics. Thanks as always, Zapiro.
Thank you.
Here's a question. How do you counter a terrorist group that has a well-oiled propaganda machine? Meet Abdullah X. He's the protagonist of an animated video series on YouTube. Abdullah is basically a cartoon talking head. The guy who created him is a British Muslim, the son of Pakistani immigrants, and he once belonged to an extremist group himself. He doesn't want to tell us his name.
I can't give you my name. There are always going to be people who hate people like me.
These days, he uses his own experience to try to prevent other young people from joining the likes of ISIS. He does this through his animated alter ego.
Abdullah X is in his late teens, and he's at the moment in the second year of his undergraduate studies. He was born and raised in East London, and he proudly represents where he's from. I felt that his accent needed to be relatable. I felt the way he talks needs to be relatable. In fact, one of his recent videos, one of the recent Abdullah X videos, he's acknowledging the socioeconomic reality he's living in, but he's brave enough not to blame everyone else for that problem.
Despite working my fingers to the bone for my 2-1 in business and IT, I still, in truth, will probably end up as an Uber driver while my counterparts go off and get nice paid internships and drink organic mochas from a cafe in a street where people like me grew up but can no longer afford to live in. We do actually show incredible levels of resilience and awareness to those things, but also to the lies and hate spewed out by extremists.
Yeah, that was my voice. Unfortunately, we could never afford to pay actors to voice Abdullah X, so I usually have to do it. And hopefully one day we'll be able to get someone else to do it. What young Muslims like to engage is stuff that's topical, that's relevant, that's imaginative, could put a smile on their face, but could put a smirk on their face too, and make them question what they've just seen. I think he reaches the parts of the psyche that governments can't reach. So in the Syria video, what he's trying to do is enter the psyche of young people who were putting questions in Google, such as how to make your way to Syria for jihad. Press enter in a Google search engine.
Do the people of Syria really need you to go out there and fight when you don't fully know the terrain, the political reality, and the actual motivations of groups who are claiming to be fighting for Islam? If you have families and even basic responsibilities where you live, how would you justify leaving them for a conflict in which Muslims are essentially killing other Muslims indiscriminately and without regard for the Islamic principles of warfare and the protection of civilian life? More next week, inshallah, on another topic that is current or that will not go away. Abdullah X. Peace.
When the first Abdullah X video on Syria came out, even Daesh, or the so-called Islamic State, felt the need to respond to it. They felt the need to write a 5,000-word refutation and rebuttal to a 2-minute video. I mean, I know that most, if not all, extremist narratives prey on someone's sense of identity, someone's need for belonging, someone's need for a sense of loyalty and duty. I was no different. I'm a former extremist myself. Some of my understanding of how extremists recruit and radicalize young people, some of that knowledge is in the narrative of Abdullah X. I was involved in these various networks from about the age of 16 until my late 20s. I became very adept at spotting vulnerabilities in other people. I became someone who could sit in a university canteen and spot the body language of a young Muslim who doesn't feel like he fits in completely and lacks confidence. My job was to find people like that, bring them to the ideology, and then move them along. If you've been one of those people, you actually know exactly what they want to achieve and how they want to achieve it. About 3 months ago, Abdullah X got a private Facebook message on his Facebook page with a young man imploring us, "Brother, please, whatever you do, don't stop making this content. Please carry on." So we're not assuming that this is about reaching masses of people, because masses of people aren't vulnerable to these issues. But there may just be one young man who sees on his screen an Abdullah X advert flash across, and he may click it. It might save him buying a plane ticket.
That was the creator of the animated YouTube series Abdullah X. He told his story to producer Sonia Narang, and you can see one of the videos at PRI.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. If you like classic fairy tale endings, you might want to steer clear of Japanese literature.
Instead of the prince killing the ogre and marrying the princess and finding a pot of gold, maybe is left with an image of Mount Fuji, you know, sort of pondering eternity.
That story plus Gaddafi's golden gun, still to come here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I want to read you a recent quote from a Pentagon spokesman. Rear Admiral John Kirby said, "No other military on Earth takes concerns over collateral damage and civilian casualties more seriously than we do. We, as in the United States military." Now, that may be, but a new investigation by our partners at Global Post suggests the U.S. war against ISIS is putting that statement to a serious test. Almost every day, American airstrikes are hitting Islamic State targets in Syria and Iraq, and the investigation found evidence that those strikes have killed far more civilians than the Pentagon admits. Paul Wood of the BBC and correspondent Richard Hall in Beirut co-wrote the Global Post story. I spoke with Richard earlier. So for this investigation, Richard, you investigated several bombings. Let's talk about one in particular on a village called Al-Ghara that was back in May of last year. Who did you speak to and what did you find out?
Well, we traveled to Turkey in this instance and spoke to the son of a man who was killed in that airstrike. He wasn't there at the time of the airstrike, but he found out immediately after his father was killed, and he rushed back to the village from Turkey. He saw the destruction caused by the bombing. He spoke to his relatives and buried his father. So we were able to get a lot of information from the son of the guy that was killed.
And Al-Ghara is in Syria. Is it held by ISIS right now?
It's actually changed hands a few times. It's held by the Kurds at the moment. At the time of the bombing, it was held by, well, ISIS were in control of the area, let's put it that way. They were going in and out of the village. They didn't hold the village all the time, but they were in control of the area. It's on a, Al-Ghara is a very small village at the foot of a mountain called Mount Abdulaziz, which is in northern Syria in Hasaka province.
How many civilians do you believe were killed in that attack? And how many does the U.S. Central Command say were killed?
The U.S. Central Command have denied bombing Al-Ghara. And this was part of our investigation, was looking into instances where U.S. has denied bombing a certain place, but there is a wealth of circumstantial evidence to suggest that they have. And this was one of the strongest cases that we found during our investigation. So the U.S. has denied hitting Al-Ghara. We have reason to believe that they did and that they need to go back and look again.
What else were you looking at? Because it wasn't just cases where the U.S. denied totally that they bombed a particular spot, but also the numbers vary greatly as to how many civilians were killed in individual airstrikes, correct?
That's right. So basically, the number of civilians that the U.S. has admitted killing is 22 since the operation began. The number that monitoring groups, independent monitoring groups, say have been killed is between 862 and 1,116. So what our investigation was to look at why these numbers were so different. And what we found during that process was that the investigation process that the coalition engages in after they've received an allegation of civilian casualties is substandard.
Yeah, explain the kind of investigation. How does it all work and where does the accountability fall apart?
At the very early stages, actually. So what we did find was when the U.S. Central Command does launch an investigation, they're very, very thorough. The problem is with getting to that stage, they do these things called credibility checks, which is when they receive an allegation, they look into it initially to see whether it's worth investigating further. And this is where it all fell down. They would, what we found during the investigation was that they would often type in the name of a village, a very small village, into their database to see if they carried out an airstrike there. And if that village didn't turn up on their database, they would brush the allegation off and move on. A lot of these villages in Syria, they don't turn up on maps. They're spelt several different ways by different people. Even Mount Abdulaziz, the mountain where this village was, is called something different by the Kurds who live in the same area. So we suspect on a number of occasions that there might have been different spellings, or they might have inputted, the coalition might have inputted only one spelling and it didn't turn up on the database. The point was that they often relied just on searching their database with the village name. We were able to look into a number of these airstrikes in more detail and provide more evidence than the coalition had, which then forced them to go back and look again at their records.
Yeah. So, Richard, you investigated, what, a half dozen or so different events. How do these all fit in with the broader pattern of civilian casualties from U.S. airstrikes in Iraq and Syria right now?
It's very hard to say because we could only look in detail at airstrikes in which we had information of our own. I mean, we could take a cursory look at other airstrikes where people have investigated, but we looked in detail at about three or four. And with regards to the larger pattern, we can't say very much. In fact, we can just say on these occasions, the investigation that was done following the airstrike was substandard. And our conclusion, I guess, is that this could be happening over and over again. And that could be a reason why the number that independent monitoring groups give for civilian casualties and the number that the U.S. military says are so different.
Richard Hall with our partners at Global Post speaking with me from Beirut. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maka.
It's been more than 4 years now since the revolution in Libya. The country is still engulfed in chaos and violence. But back on October 20th, 2011, Libyans were celebrating the capture and death of their longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. One image from that day still sticks out, a young rebel triumphantly waving Gaddafi's personal gold-plated gun in the air. My BBC colleague Gabriel Gatehouse witnessed that moment, and he recently went back to Libya to search for the golden gun itself.
On the day that I first saw it, Marco, I have to tell you, it was just complete and utter chaos. There were rebels everywhere. They were firing off their Kalashnikovs. But there was this one guy, and he was wearing a blue T-shirt with the word love in it, in a big heart shape in red, and a New York Yankees baseball cap. And he was being held up on the shoulders of his comrades, and he was waving this golden pistol. It's a Browning 9mm automatic. It's got the sort of floral pattern decoration and various inscriptions. It's a souvenir, if you like. But my understanding is it's a working handgun.
Right. So after Gaddafi was killed that day, what happened to the gun? Was it still in the hands of that rebel kid who was waving it in the air?
So on that day itself, actually, I saw it in the hands of numerous different rebels. It kept popping up. I'd go to one location, I'd see it in the hands of one rebel, I'd go to another, then went to the drainage pipe where they found Gaddafi hiding, and it was in the hands of other rebels. So it kept popping up. And then for several months after the end of the revolution, various fighters who were by then regarded as heroes would be pictured with it. And there's a very sad story associated with one of those guys, Omran Shaban. He's actually featured quite prominently in some of the shaky cell phone footage that you see of the capture of Colonel Gaddafi. You can see him. He's trying to keep Colonel Gaddafi alive. He's trying to hold back the mob because he wanted Colonel Gaddafi to stand trial. There was this hope that the toppling of the dictator would result in a shift from dictatorship to the rule of law.
Now, a lot of Libyans were hoping that.
Right, and as we see, that was not to be. And perhaps the fate of this one guy, Omran Shaban, who tried to keep Gaddafi alive, is sort of a symbol of what's happened to Libya. He was captured by pro-Gaddafi remnants less than a year after Colonel Gaddafi was killed. They tortured him, they beat him. By the time his family had managed to negotiate a release, he was so badly injured that he died shortly afterwards of his wounds. Mm.
So at the time Gaddafi was killed, this gun was like a trophy marking the end of the regime. You've been back to Libya to try and find this gun. What did you discover?
Well, I tried to find some of the people who I'd photographed with the gun on that day. So I told you the story about Omran Shaban, the guy who was killed. I saw his father, and he pointed me in the direction of another of the fighters who I pictured with the gun. He actually has now joined a brigade. He's still fighting. He's joined a brigade that's fighting against Islamic State, who've taken over the next door town. And then finally, I managed to get through to the guy in the New York Yankees baseball cap. And I phoned him up. I said, are you around? Can we meet? And he said, yeah, sure, I'm around. We met. I said, do you remember this picture? He looked at it, said, yes, I remember it. I said, do you know what's happened to the gun? He said, yes, it's still with me. And there it was. He keeps it slightly hidden. He keeps it under wraps. He doesn't advertise the fact that he's got it, because in fact he's had death threats from pro-Gaddafi loyalists, people who remain loyal to the regime. And what he said to me was, he didn't have anything to do with the capture of Gaddafi. He was simply in the area, part of a different brigade. And amid all the confusion, he found this pistol lying on the ground somewhere between Gaddafi's car, which had been hit in a French airstrike, and the drainage pipe where Gaddafi had sought refuge and where he was hiding from the rebels. He found the pistol on the ground. He picked it up. All the other rebels saw him with Gaddafi's golden gun, and they thought, this is the guy who caught and killed him. So he became this instant hero.
Wow.
But this almost accidental hero. And it was such an odd feeling to be holding that gun 4.5 years later, the first time I'd seen it. It was such a symbol of hope and optimism. And now here it is, still there, almost a secret in this country that's still at war with itself.
Well, exactly. I mean, Libya's still in civil war. ISIS is in control of Gaddafi's hometown. The fighters that you met during the revolution, how did they see the country's future?
I think a lot of them feel quite bleak about it. One of the guys that I met on this story, I said, how's the situation? He said, not good. He said, we cut off the head of the snake, Gaddafi, but in its place, hundreds of other snakes have emerged. Everyone wants to be like Gaddafi. I think for a lot of these people, Islamic State to us seems like the most prominent threat. For a lot of these people, you know, there's just militias everywhere. All the rebels who were so united in common purpose during the revolution have all split along ideological, geographical lines, and all these different factions are now fighting each other for control. It's a mess.
Thanks very much for telling us these stories, Gabriel.
Always a pleasure.
The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse there telling us about his search for Gaddafi's famous gun. From that golden pistol to a golden loaf of bread. A golden loaf of bread. Yeah, that's one of the images in a new music video from Russian protest band Pussy Riot. The video set in a Soviet-era banquet hall. The Pussy Riot girls are decked out in official blue uniforms, and they dance around as they torture and abuse masked prisoners. It's a very direct dig at the Russian justice system. We turn to our friend Charles Maines to find out more. Charles reports on all things Russia.
This whole song is called Chaika, which is a reference to the prosecutor general in Russia who's been accused of graft. And so essentially, this is kind of an ode to corruption in the higher ranks of the Kremlin.
Yeah, and the lyrics kind of serve as a warning of what will happen to you if you kind of get in the grips of the Kremlin. It's not very pleasant.
It's not very pleasant, but there is a certain sense, and they put this in the song, that if you're loyal in the Kremlin, that you'll be protected. You hear that in the lyrics in the song. It says sort of, be humble, learn to obey. If you want to get away with murder, be loyal to your boss.
So it's this well-known member of Pussy Riot, Nadia, who appeared in the episode of House of Cards, who is playing Chaika. What does Chaika represent for people in Russia?
Well, he is the sort of number one cop. Of course, if you look at the court system in Russia, which is notorious for its conviction rates, it's above a 99% conviction rate, the idea that he's sort of the chief sentencer. So I think that in particular, though, with Yuri Chaika, there was an investigation done by the opposition leader, Alexei Navalny's anti-corruption organization, in which they accused Chaika of essentially graft, of ties to mafia groups, of secret holdings abroad, of sort of grand palaces in Europe. You know, he's denied all these things, blaming it essentially on a CIA plot.
And apparently Alexei Navalny put out his own video back in December.
That's right. Not just Navalny, but his fund. He has sort of a collection of a team that he works with. They try and look for legal documents that can prove graft in different forms.
Yeah, I mean, Pussy Riot, Navalny, a lot of people suspect the Kremlin of corruption, but is there any actual evidence?
There is some evidence. If you look at essentially Putin's closest associates, his friends from his days in St. Petersburg, they've all established enormous wealth over the past decade. Also, there was recently a Transparency International report, which essentially ranked Russia as fairly corrupt, came out 119th on the index. That's worse than many of its neighbors and certainly far below Europe.
Now, in response to the Pussy Riot song and video, I gather that Putin's supporters have also put out their own series of corruption videos. Have you seen them?
Putin's All-Russian Popular Front, this is sort of a pro-Putin organization that Mr. Putin formed himself, just put out an animated video that's kind of like a South Park Kilkenny scenario.
Right.
Where Putin is constantly executing officials that have been accused of corruption in various creative ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost supporting what Pussy Riot warns about in the Chaika song about the justice system doing whatever they want with you. I mean, it's kind of like Robot Chicken.
It is a little bit like Robot Chicken, and it's a little bit creepy given the recent report that was out of London looking at the murder of the former KGB agent Alexander Litvinenko, in which the British court found that Mr. Putin probably approved this killing using polonium.
Yeah, well, animated Putin apparently can vaporize corrupt enemies. In the end, does this really mean anything to President Putin, the Chaika video, or does it play kind of right into his narrative about the evil influence of the West?
It probably does play into that narrative a bit, and it certainly, I think, also plays into this idea that loyalty is paramount. There has been no inquiries into the prosecutor general's activities, despite this report from Navalny, and I don't think we'll see one, and I don't think even Pussy Riot would expect to see one. So there have these sort of dueling approaches to dealing with corruption. Certainly, Pussy Riot and Navalny would say that it's the Kremlin's corrupt from the very beginning, while the Kremlin has its own anti-corruption drives that they pull out from time to time to, you know, perhaps distract, but perhaps take on corruption where they see it to be necessary. Ultimately, it's Putin's friends who stay above the fray.
I just have to ask you one more thing about the Pussy Riot video. Maybe you can explain this cultural artifact to us. There is a loaf of bread made out of some precious metal. What's going on there?
Well, that is a reference to the revolution, the Maidan Square revolution that toppled Viktor Yanukovych. This is a former president of Ukraine. When Yanukovych finally gave up power and protesters stormed essentially the presidential palace, they found these sort of immaculate grounds with all sorts of strange objects and evidence of sort of enormous wealth. But one of the stranger ones was this golden loaf of bread, which then the Ukrainians created a museum to corruption using Yanukovych's former estate. The only problem is that loaf of bread was later stolen.
Uh-huh. And where is it now?
Nobody knows, but maybe Pussy Riot grabbed it.
Everything has meaning in a Pussy Riot video. Reporter Charles Maines, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Marco.
Tiny Luxembourg wants to mine asteroids. Yeah, seriously. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. What if I told a story that started with, and they lived happily ever after? The end at the beginning. Confusing, right? Well, embrace the confusion, as Japanese-American writer Marie Mutsuki Mockett would say. She's the author of Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye, A Journey. Mockett embraces different ways of telling stories. She says in Japan, fairy tales often depict objects as having a life of their own. And that has a way of influencing culture there.
I have this private theory that it's one of the reasons why the Japanese are so good at design. You know, they're so good at designing the perfect pencil or cup because they see objects as being alive. It's just not just a thing. It's just when you pick up a cup, you want to feel good about this cup and feel that it's an object that almost has a soul. And there are even these beautiful hand scrolls that I've seen which depict the idea that if an object makes it to 99 years, when it turns 100, it has the chance to have a soul.
Wow.
And therefore people would throw away objects after 99 years. And so there are these hand scrolls depicting the angry 99-year-old rejected objects that are coming back to wreak havoc on the owners who threw them away. And I talked about this concept with my mom once, and I'm sure I was going on and on saying, what does it mean? And she said, what it really means is you're supposed to take care of everything around you in life. You're supposed to take care of a chair and a parasol so that it can last 100 years. You're not supposed to just throw things away. And when you go to Japan, things are very carefully taken care of and packaged, which has another problem because they do wrap everything in paper. But there's something I think valuable in the idea that when you have a cup or when you have a book, you want to take care of it and not just think, oh, I have this for now, I can throw it away and get another one. But that objects are to be taken care of and preserved, almost as though they do have a soul. I think that's sort of a nice attitude to have, and perhaps an attitude that we're coming around to again.
It's a great attitude. Marie, your mother's Japanese, your father's American, is that it?
That's right, yes.
Right. When you put out the memoir last year, Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye, A Journey, the New York Times remarked about your double-sidedness, bringing to bear both the dry rationality of the West and the sticky sensibilities professed by the Japanese. Is your perspective on storytelling, you know, opening up our minds to different ways of telling stories, is it more feasible when it is someone like you who has this dual kind of background and this dual vision?
Oh, I think it's possible, but I tend to have great faith in people. And I also feel like there's so many young people who are hungry for stories that aren't just produced by the same Hollywood machinery, and maybe not even just younger people, but people who like to see stories that are different, that offer a human perspective that maybe is slightly different from the culture from which they come. So maybe it's easier for me, or maybe I just spend a lot of time trying to analyze what is the difference and what am I seeing and why is it different and what are we responding to?
What would you
There's
say
so
the difference
many young...
is?
One of the differences is in fairy tales, this wonderful Japanese Jungian psychologist says, a number of Japanese fairy tales resolve with a beautiful image derived from nature. So at the end of the fairy tale, instead of the prince killing the ogre and marrying the princess and finding a pot of gold, whoever the hero is we've followed through the fairy tale maybe is left with an image of Mount Fuji and smoke coming up from it, you know, sort of pondering eternity, which is a different value. And I think those of us who travel and who are aware that all human experience is valuable like those stories because they stretch us and make us grow. And we want to be able to see the world in a way that's different from our own. You know, people like that feeling of being challenged and of being asked to see the world differently because we are more connected and it's easier than ever to get someplace if you want to.
Marie Mutsuki-Maka, the author of Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye, A Journey, has just been named as a finalist for the Penn Open Book Award. Marie, congratulations and thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Now, this last story today may sound like a fairy tale. Tiny Luxembourg is setting its goals in space. It's launching a plan to promote the commercial mining of asteroids. Luxembourg is serious about this, and a U.S. company is hoping to join the project. Chris Lewicki is CEO of Planetary Resources in Washington State.
Hi, Marco.
Well, Luxembourg is actually a pioneer in commercial space development. They were responsible for helping develop commercial satellite communications 30 years ago, and they're looking to recreate that same development, but now see space resources and the economic development of space as the next big opportunity.
Yeah, so what do we mean when we say space resources? Like, what kind of minerals are on asteroids that we don't have in large supply here on Earth?
Well, there is a bunch of extremely useful resources, and I would encourage you first to actually think about using those resources in space. Resources like water or metals for construction, or radiation shielding or rocket fuel. All of these can be found on the surface of near-Earth asteroids, which are orbiting the sun right alongside the Earth. Eventually, in the perfection of the industry, we'll be able to bring back extremely valuable but extremely useful materials like the platinum group metals. So this is the beginning of the gold rush in space, and we're very excited to see Luxembourg's leadership in this area.
So the space station and its astronauts, they'll still be getting supplies from Earth. But what you're saying, if this initiative goes through, the space station is going to start treating asteroids like the local Home Depot to just get materials?
Well, that's the plan. And being able to use resources in space gives us tremendous leverage, because the shipping cost of every pound of anything that we send up in space is just incredibly high. And everything that we can get closer to where we're at in space is really going to help us accelerate the further economic development in space. Being able to build things, being able to support human activity, you know, everything that we've done here on Earth, we can repeat in space.
But bringing all that stuff back to Earth, whether it's water or platinum, isn't that just going to kind of completely skyrocket the price because of what it costs to get up there?
Well, in this case, we can use robotic technology, the same technology that helped rovers land and drive on Mars. The same technology that's helping autonomous cars drive around is something that we can actually, without ever having to have a human have to go, we can explore and develop these resources on asteroids.
One company said that asteroids are the low-hanging fruit of the solar system. You agree with that?
I do. Asteroids are actually the most accessible destination in space once you get into Earth orbit. And even though the moon is out there every night, the moon's got a lot of gravity that you have to fight in order to land on it and to come back from it. But asteroids have very little gravity, so you don't land with them, you dock with them. And that makes them much more attractive targets for rocket scientists going out to look for resources in space.
Is this all going to happen in our lifetimes?
It's happening right now. Our company has put satellites into space already, and our goal is actually to have the first privately funded commercial mission to an asteroid by the end of this decade, and we hope to be starting the initial mining activity in the beginning of the 2020s. So if we can create the machines and we can go out to space and get those resources, we can bring that shipping cost down and help really establish a new presence for humanity in space.
Chris Lewicki is CEO of Planetary Resources. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And that's The World Today. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow from the Nan and Bill Harris studios.
PRI, Public Radio International.